please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Like all technologies, artificial intelligence or AI requires governance to create an enabling environment and regulatory policies that maximize its benefits. We're prepared for you an article written by Deepali Khanna. The piece is titled Keys to Making AI a Force for Social Good. The article has been published by Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Deepali Khanna's article. Artificial intelligence systems are shaping the contours of our lives, with applications in agriculture, healthcare, education, transportation, manufacturing, and the media. Artificial intelligence has become as pervasive as the internet itself. While it can significantly improve the well-being of humanity, it also has certain downsides. Reinforcement of human biases, displacement of jobs and industries, and privacy risks. Thus, like all technologies, it requires governance to create an enabling environment and regulatory policies that maximize its benefits and reduce risks. However, artificial intelligence governance poses many challenges. There is no single universal idea of what its goals and outcomes should be. For instance, an aviation safety system seeks to prevent accidents. But artificial intelligence regulators cannot have a similar exclusive aim. Moreover, since artificial intelligence is not a single application, but an underlying technology with diverse uses, terms like good artificial intelligence or bad artificial intelligence are as meaningless as good electricity or bad electricity. Thus, governance must take into account the range of contexts and uses of artificial intelligence. Further complicating matters is the speed with which artificial intelligence learns and evolves, often in ways that are not understood. As our current regulatory models cannot deal with these rapid changes, they might end up stifling innovation and fail to prevent harmful artificial intelligence applications. Confronted with these unprecedented challenges, what must we do? To explore potential roadmaps, we build upon insights shared by industry experts, government officials, leading thinkers and intellectuals and practitioners at two critical events we were part of: the Artificial Intelligence for Social Good Summit and the Innovating Artificial Intelligence Government Symposium. Here's how policymakers can negotiate some of the challenges posed by artificial intelligence governance and harness its transformative potential. While each pilot use case may require a bespoke approach until the consequences of that model are fully realized, here are a few examples. Strategic regulation. To promote innovation, governments must create safe, enabling spaces for experimentation. They can do this by deploying artificial intelligence applications at a limited scale, under the observation of regulators. Such pilot tests can help determine the potential benefits and downsides, and further fine-tune technologies before releasing them in the public sphere through an effective feedback loop. Artificial intelligence localism, the governance of artificial intelligence use within a community or city, can nurture a bottom-up regulatory approach. It allows policies to be adapted to local conditions and the needs of communities, as opposed to a cookie-cutter approach. At the local level, citizens can also closely observe and have more of a say in how artificial intelligence is used. For such regulation to be effective, policymakers must understand the development process of artificial intelligence systems, their strengths and their weaknesses, and the types of data used. They must become more technology literate and form working groups that enable collaboration among regulators, developers, and users. However, in such collaborative efforts, policymakers must regulate acceptable outcomes of artificial intelligence use rather than specific technologies and specific applications. Take the case of artificial intelligence systems that determine if applicants are eligible for a loan or a job. There have been incidents of algorithms discriminating against people based on their race, based on their gender or address. In such cases, governance should find and stem biases rather than regulate the mechanism the artificial intelligence system uses to make decisions. They can do this through peer reviews, with diverse participants who can challenge each other's presumptions and ensure representation of different points of view. Manage job disruptions. While artificial intelligence will create many jobs, it will also upend old ones, which has prompted a pushback against certain technologies. For instance, taxi drivers have lobbied against self-driving vehicles. While various studies show that job losses to automation could be in their millions, quite a few, such as by the World Economic Forum, WEF, also point out that artificial intelligence will create more jobs than it displaces. Thus, policymakers need to address the concerns of those who might lose their jobs and create alternatives such as reskilling, job transition support, and employment guarantees. They must also strengthen social safety nets to cushion the impact of job losses. In the long run, they must overhaul the education system to focus on lifelong learning and helping workers transition rather than preparing them for a single career. Besides, with the development for artificial intelligence workers exceeding the supply, governments will have to develop and retrain talent to capitalize on the artificial intelligence revolution. Nurture artificial intelligence markets. While governments have been investing in research, technologies, and infrastructure to promote artificial intelligence, these measures alone are insufficient. They should further boost the artificial intelligence ecosystem by identifying potential uses of artificial intelligence applications and encouraging prospective customers within and outside the government to adopt them. By becoming a market player and facilitator, governments can create a demand for artificial intelligence applications that contribute to social good. For example, India is setting up a national program for artificial intelligence to incorporate artificial intelligence into government applications and public service delivery, with support from a team of young professionals from the International Innovation Corps. address privacy concerns. Some regard stronger privacy protections as an impediment to the growth of artificial intelligence, as they could limit data availability. However, that does not have to be the case. For instance, policymakers can safeguard privacy by legislating frameworks to anonymize data. This ensures that sensitive data is available to artificial intelligence applications without compromising the privacy of individuals. Japan has taken this route, with a law permitting research institutions to use the anonymized medical data of patients collected by hospitals. Policymakers can also explore relevant data stewards that can make sensitive data accessible by anonymizing and centralizing it. Such data stewards could ensure proper management and sharing of data with informed consent and requisite permissions from data providers. Global cooperation. The adoption of these strategies to govern artificial intelligence varies across nations. Their socio-economic conditions, access to technology, and ethical approaches determine to a large extent whether they can channel artificial intelligence for social good. Thus, to ensure that artificial intelligence systems create a more inclusive playing field and do not deepen disparities among countries, we require global governance. It could incorporate aspects from models of international cooperation on climate change, on arms control, trade and finance. Just as the Bretton Woods Conference towards the end of the Second World War resulted in new regulatory frameworks and multilateral institutions such as the World Bank, global efforts could address the challenges of artificial intelligence governance. There already are initiatives in this direction. In 2019, for example, the Council of Europe set up an ad hoc committee on artificial intelligence, which is working towards a legally binding international treaty. Last year saw the establishment of the Global Partnership on Artificial Intelligence. The COVID-19 pandemic has further reinforced the need for global cooperation in artificial intelligence. The next step in the evolution of establishing flexible yet robust governance as we transition from principles to practice is the need to work together with a common set of goals to spur inclusive, innovative artificial intelligence and better govern the world of tomorrow, as described in a new report entitled Artificial Intelligence Plus Governance, Bold Action and Novel Approaches.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it routinely launches airstrikes against targets in Syria. It is also widely blamed for high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran. The regime is believed to have carried out the recent sabotage attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, which operates under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was quick to pledge to retaliate for the attack on Natanz. Tel Aviv apparently knows no limit when it comes to clandestine operations against other countries. The regime always says it carries out such actions out of worries for its own security. Such dangerous policies could be starting to backfire. This week, a sensitive missile factory in central Israel was rocked by a powerful blast. The huge explosion, which created a mushroom cloud, hit the Tomer factory for advanced weapons. Israeli officials say the blast was a test. On Thursday, a missile fired from Syria landed near the secretive Dimona nuclear weapons facility, triggering warning sirens. The Israeli military said the projectile was a surface-to-air missile fired by Syrian forces against Israeli warplanes. It says the projectile overflew its target and landed near Dimona. But the heavily protected nuclear facility is some 300 kilometers south of Damascus. It is a very long distance for an errant missile. The missile fired from Syria on Thursday landed just some 30 kilometers away from the notorious Israeli nuclear facility. Military experts say this has once again revealed that much-trumpeted Israeli air defenses are penetrable. The projectile made it through the air defense layers despite the fact that anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems around Dimona have been significantly boosted in anticipation of a possible retaliatory missile or drone attack by Iran or resistance groups close to Iran.
By looking at this particular site, Dimona, where this weapon nearly hit, it's saying, well, if you really want to have some sort of fight, you do realise that your nuclear facilities, we know exactly where they are, and they could be hit too. And I'm afraid just simply repeating the lies about the impenetrability of the Israeli air defences and missile defences is not going to save anybody in a conflict. It's really just hot air.
Israeli media, like the Times of Israel, have highlighted the fact that the missile landed deep inside Israel amid heightened tensions with Iran and after Tehran's pledge of retaliation. Some other media organizations, like the Middle East Monitor, said Netanyahu's comments after the attack on Natanz looked like a claim of responsibility, and this may have pushed Iran to retaliate. Israel seems increasingly worried about the possibility of the United States removing sanctions against Iran to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal that America abandoned under former President Donald Trump. Israel has always been a vociferous critic of the deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for possible repercussions for the region and beyond.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are holding talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, trying to salvage the accord. The 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been at crisis ever since the United States left the pact unilaterally in 2018 and imposed sanctions against Iran. While Tehran's precondition for returning to compliance is removal of all U.S. sanctions, Washington has so far refrained from doing so. U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley, in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. Current U.S. officials and sources close to American and European negotiators have now been saying that the U.S. is dividing the post-JCPOA sanctions into JCPOA-related and non-JCPOA-related ones, and intends to remove only the former. The presence of numerous Iranian names on the United States specially designated nationals and blocked persons list, even if apparently unimportant individuals, would also sharply restrict the ceiling for Iran's benefits from the JCPOA. Iran wants these names to also be removed. Iran, meanwhile, is saying that it considers all those sanctions as JCPOA-related because they were imposed with the intent to affect the deal and its implementation, or most recently, the negotiations to revive it. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with a 2015 nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after rapid verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. The main sanctions were imposed on Iran's oil and banking sectors. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the nuclear accord.
Well, certainly there are sanctions that were imposed under the Trump administration separate from the JCPOA that were designed to make it more difficult for the Biden administration to get back into the deal. But the Biden administration had time before it came into the White House, and now it's been 3 months. They have had the time to figure out how to lift those sanctions that were not related to the JCPOA.
During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA. Trump reimposed a series of expansive sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the deal, this time not under the pretext of concerns about Iran's nuclear program, which the JCPOA had already addressed, but under new labels, for instance, so-called sponsorship for terrorism. However, Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. While the U.S. seems to try to use the sanctions as leverage in the negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has made it clear that it will only return to its commitments under the accord once it has verified that all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed.
Certainly, if there are remaining sanctions that are having an impact on the Iranian bank, for example, that makes it hard to have transactions with not only the U.S., but countries all over the world, that is problematic. If there continue to be sanctions that make other companies in countries outside the U.S. Worried about doing business with Iran because they continue to be afraid that they will be sanctioned by the United States, that is problematic. And so the U.S. really has to lift all of these sanctions because they are interconnected.
Iran is articulating what should happen in order for the deal to be revived in its original form. By refusing to listen, the United States and Europe are only making it more difficult for the prospect to materialize.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it will force Israel to free Palestinian prisoners. Senior Hamas official Khaled Mash'al said the issue of Palestinian prisoners is a top priority for all Palestinians. Mash'al said Hamas is keen on conveying the prisoners' message to the international community. He underlined the fact that Israel will not release Palestinian prisoners except through resistance by Palestinians and that negotiations are not the way forward. The comments came as Palestinians just marked the Prisoners' Day. On April 17th of each year, Palestinians express their loyalty to those imprisoned by the regime and as a reminder of their legitimate struggle for freedom. An estimated 4,500 Palestinians are languishing in Israeli jails, many for simply challenging Israel's occupation. They include 41 women and 140 children below 18 years. Since the beginning of 2021, Israeli authorities have arrested nearly 1,400 Palestinians. Some estimates have put the number of Palestinians to have been jailed at over 1 million.
Well, on the 22nd November 1974, the United Nations General Assembly recognized the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination, national independence, and sovereignty of Palestine. And these jailings of the people of Palestine are in complete contradiction to the UN General Assembly resolution. The Palestinians have a right to resist, they have a right for their homeland, and what we've seen is this systematic jailing of Palestinians. Now, whether the resistance is through the PLO, the PFLP, Hamas, the authority, or individual Palestinians is irrelevant. The relevance is that this is a criminalization, not just of a community, but of a whole nation. The figure of 1 million is shocking when we bear in mind that the population of Palestine currently is estimated at 5 million. That means that 20% of the entire population of a nation has been jailed at one particular time. And this figure in itself is shocking. It's a shocking figure, and it's something that should be rejected, and Palestinian people need to be supported in their legal battle and in their right to a homeland.
The Palestinian Prisoners' Day comes as nearly 550 inmates suffer from various diseases and require close monitoring and health care. At least 10 inmates suffer from cancer of varying degrees, including Fuad al-Shubaki, 82, the oldest of the prisoners. So far, 368 jailed Palestinians have been infected with the coronavirus. Some Palestinians have spent 4 years in captivity, with 543 sentenced to several life sentences. That brings to the spotlight the fact that the regime continues with its violation of Palestinian human rights.
Palestinians have suffered human rights abuses for decades and decades now. It will only stop when Palestinians have the right to return, when Palestinians have their homeland, and when they can legally control their own destiny. At the moment, Palestinians have very few rights, and this is part of the problem that they've been facing for many years now.
But Tel Aviv's violation of rights does not suffice to that. The regime has kept nearly 3 million Gazans under a tight blockade since 2007. As long as the coronavirus pandemic is concerned, the Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for healthcare workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic. In the occupied West Bank, the regime continues with its other violations, including settlement expansions. But why isn't the international community able to put an end to these Israeli crimes?
Well, the situation in terms of Israel-Palestine is part of a global situation. There are vested interests on both sides, and clearly the power resides against the Palestinians. There are many national organizations, international organizations, and nations who are supporting the Palestinian rights, and they should continue to do so until Palestinians get what they deserve under the UN Convention.
Israel has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since day one of its installment in the region by its Western creators. Tel Aviv enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular. No matter which party's candidate wins the race for the White House in U.S. presidential elections, there is an unwritten tradition in the U.S. foreign policy which regards the Israeli regime as a sacrosanct. In line with that tradition, each and every meaningful effort to call Tel Aviv to account at the UN Security Council over its crimes has been aborted by the U.S. that holds veto power at the world body.
The United States announced last week its plan to withdraw all its troops from Afghanistan. In a White House speech, President Joe Biden said it was time to end Washington's longest war in history.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Biden said the withdrawal will begin from May 1st and conclude by September 11 this year. Shortly after his announcement, NATO said in a statement that it will coordinate its troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan with the United States.
In the light of the U.S. decision to withdraw, foreign and defense ministers of NATO discussed the way forward today and decided that we will start the withdrawal of NATO Resource Support Mission forces by May 1st.
The NATO chief said it is now up to the Afghans to reach sustainable peace. But the U.S. government has kept silent about whether it will also withdraw American private contractors conducting operations there.
So on the contractors, we don't know exactly. There's some preliminary plans. Clearly, the goal is to get all our personnel out. And I suspect that contractors will be part of that. Whether there'll still be a need for some contractor support, I just don't know. We don't have that level of detail right now. We're still working through that.
The New York Times has cited U.S. officials as saying that the U.S. is planning to continue its presence in Afghanistan by keeping the contractors and operatives in the country following the withdrawal of its troops.
Biden is trying to present himself as a new kind of president. And to do that, he has to make some pretend announcements that things are changing. This is one of them.
So why has the U.S. decided to pull out its forces if it's so keen on keeping its military presence there? Washington-linked private security companies have a long history of committing war crimes and interfering in countries around the world. Perhaps one of the most notorious of the American private contractors is Blackwater, now renamed Academy, which has been involved in several major scandals. The most notable was an incident in 2007 in Iraq, when four Blackwater security personnel killed 14 civilians, two of whom children. Former U.S. President Donald Trump exacerbated this scandal by pardoning the contractors in his final days in office. But Blackwater is not the only such American firm that is active in conducting high-level overseas operations.
America has approximately 500 military bases around the planet. It has hundreds of major bases, and then it has hundreds of minor bases. So Afghanistan is just one peg in a worldwide network of military bases that the United States uses to put pressure on different regions to support its political, economic, and social goals as an empire.
Back in May 2020, Venezuela arrested 13 individuals charged with planning an operation in the capital, Caracas, two of whom were American nationals. The U.S. mercenaries admitted that they were arrested during a failed attempt to raid Venezuela's presidential palace and seize President Nicolas Maduro. Considering the controversy surrounding the presence of U.S. private security firms abroad, experts believe Washington seeks a lower level of accountability by reducing the number of its declared troops in countries like Afghanistan.
America is an empire. President Biden is the current administrator of that empire. There's a lot of opposition among the people of America to never-ending so-called forever wars.
What's certain is that the United States is unwilling to leave the region, no matter if that would translate into the privatization of its wars in West Asia.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
A white sheriff's deputy in the San Francisco Bay Area shot and killed a black man in the middle of a busy intersection about a minute after trying to stop him on suspicion of throwing rocks at cars last month, newly released video shows. The graphic body camera video footage shows Andrew Hall shooting Tyrell Wilson, a 33-year-old, within seconds of asking him to drop a knife on 11th of March this year in Danville, California. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, "California Officer Charged in Previous Shooting Kills Black Man at Intersection, Video Shows." Stay with us for more of the article by The Guardian. White sheriff's deputy in the San Francisco Bay Area in California shot and killed a black man in the middle of a busy intersection about a minute after trying to stop him on suspicion of throwing rocks at cars last month, according to a newly released video. The graphic body camera footage shows Andrew Hall shooting Tyrell Wilson, a 33-year-old, within seconds of asking him to drop a knife on 11th of March this year in Danville, California. The video footage was released on Wednesday, 21st of April, 2021, the same day prosecutors charged Andrew Hall with manslaughter and assault in the fatal shooting of an unarmed civilian more than 2 years ago, and intensified criticism of local prosecutors for not taking a quicker decision in the 2018 killing. The video released this week shows Andrew Hall calling out to Tyrell Wilson and walking towards him as Wilson walks away. Tyrell Wilson eventually turns to face the deputy holding a knife and says, "Touch me and see what's up." As they stand in the intersection, Andrew Hall asks him three times to drop the knife as Tyrell Wilson motions towards his face saying, "Kill me." Andrew Hall shoots once and Wilson drops to the ground as drivers watch and record video. The entire confrontation lasts about a minute. An attorney for Tyrell Wilson's family released another video on Thursday, 22nd of April, taken by someone stopped at the intersection. "It doesn't seem like he was doing anything," someone says. The attorney, John Burris, said Andrew Hall was unnecessarily aggressive towards Tyrell Wilson, who was not causing any problems and was backing away from the deputy before he was shot without warning. "This is a homeless man. He's walking away, minding his own business. He's basically saying, 'Go away, leave me alone.'" The attorney, John Burris, said, "But you felt compelled to kill him." Contra Costa County Sheriff David Livingston said the videos showed Terrell Wilson was threatening Andrew Hall and was possibly throwing rocks at drivers. He did threaten Officer Hall, Livingston said, and he did start advancing towards the police officer Andrew Hall in the middle of a major intersection. Police officers are forced to make split-second decisions to protect themselves and the public, and that's what happened in this case. The attorney, John Burris, also represents the family of Lordimer Arboleda, a 33-year-old Filipino man shot 9 times by Andrew Hall during a slow-moving car chase in 2018. Deputies slowly pursued Arboleda through the city of Danville, California, after someone reported a suspicious person in November of 2018. Sheriff's Department video shows Andrew Hall stopping his patrol car, getting out, and running towards the car Arboleda was driving. Police officer Andrew Hall opened fire and kept shooting as Arboleda's car passed by, striking him at least 9 times. Hall testified at an inquest that he was afraid that Arboleda would run him over. The Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office this week brought criminal charges against police officer Andrew Hall, a rare occurrence in police shootings. The office said it charged Andrew Hall with felony voluntary manslaughter and felony assault with a semi-automatic firearm in that shooting incident. Officer Hall used unreasonable and unnecessary force when he responded to the in-progress traffic pursuit involving Lordimer Arboleda, endangering not only Mr. Arboleda's life, but the lives of his fellow police officers and citizens in the immediate area, the district attorney, Diana Becton, said in a news release. Attorney John Burris said both Terrell Wilson and Lordimer Arboleda were mentally ill. Police officer Andrew Hall's attorney, Harry Stern, said prosecutors previously deemed the deputy's use of force in the 2018 case as justified. The timing of their sudden reversal in deciding to file charges seems suspect and overtly political, Hall's attorney Harry Stern said.
Communique.
Sabotage and terrorism at the nuclear enrichment facility in Natanz, Iran. An attack widely attributed to Israel, backed by the United States. It comes just as talks are underway in Vienna to revive the Iran nuclear deal. So what was the real target of this sabotage? The enrichment facility or the diplomatic talks in Vienna? Let's find out. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On April 10th, 2021, Iran marked its National Nuclear Technology Day by announcing the implementation of new centrifuges at its enrichment facility in Natanz. Iran's President Rouhani announced a chain of 164 centrifuges of the IR-6 model of Iran's newer generation centrifuges, producing 10 times more than the previous chain. However, the following day, on Sunday, April 11th, it was Iran's Atomic Energy Agency that released a statement saying an accident had taken place at Natanz. Reportedly, a power cut had resulted in damage to some of these centrifuges from an older generation. Very shortly afterwards, it became clear that this wasn't actually the result of an accident, but that of an attack, of sabotage. Again, the chief of Iran's Atomic Energy Agency, Ali Akbar Salehi, calling it a heinous move and a failure, which would not impede Iran's progress. The New York Times reporting a conflicting story saying that it wasn't a power blackout, but the result of an explosion, citing unnamed intelligence officials. Now, the first clues about who is responsible for the attack came from Khan, an Israeli public radio, which cited anonymous intelligence sources that Israel's spy service, the Mossad, was behind the operation. Amichai Stein, an Israeli public broadcaster, also tweeted out that the Mossad was responsible. There were several other veiled comments from Israeli officials, no less from Netanyahu, who just the day before had said, quote, "The struggle against Iran and its proxies and the Iranian armament efforts is a huge mission. The situation that exists today will not necessarily be the situation that will exist tomorrow." Israeli Chief of Staff Kohavi also said that, quote, "The IDF's actions throughout the Middle East are not hidden from our enemy's vision, who are observing us, seeing our capabilities, and carefully considering their next steps." Perhaps purposely vague, the timing of these statements in the wake of the attack is certainly peculiar, to say the least. The leaks from the Israeli intelligence to the media that Israel was behind the attack definitely annoyed the Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz, who was so angry at the chatter that he ended up calling for an investigation into the issue the day after the attack and the reporting in the media. Now, reacting to the incident, China strongly condemned the sabotage at the Natanz facility. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, wrote a letter to the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, in which he said, quote, "The deliberate targeting of a safeguarded nuclear facility with high risk of indiscriminate release of radioactive material is nuclear terrorism and a war crime." Shortly after the Israeli attack on the Natanz nuclear facility, Iran announced that it would be increasing uranium enrichment from 20% to 60%, a milestone that it achieved just a few days later on Friday, April 16th. Iran has also announced that it will be replacing the damaged IR-1 centrifuges with the newer generation IR-6 model and installing an additional 1,000 centrifuges in Natanz. Although Israeli media claimed that damage to the facility was so extensive that it wouldn't recover for months, well, that clearly doesn't seem to be the case. Similarly, a few months ago, when Israel killed nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020, Iran responded by increasing its uranium enrichment to 20% at the time. Under the JCPOA, Iran may only enrich uranium up to 3.67%. However, since the United States left the deal, which constitutes significant non-performance, Iran has the right under the dispute resolution mechanism to take remedial measures, such as increasing its number of centrifuges, as a pressure tactic for leverage in the diplomatic talks. Speaking of which, this latest act of sabotage at Natanz took place just as talks were underway in Vienna about how to resume the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or Iran Nuclear Deal, which was signed in 2015. Now, the Joint Commission of the JCPOA has been meeting here with the representatives of China, Iran, Russia, France, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the European Union. So far, the Biden administration has still not rejoined the Iran nuclear deal, despite promising to do so, which Trump pulled out of in 2018. Now, Israel has always been vehemently opposed to the deal, so the timing of the attack on the eve of the talks in Vienna, well, it's unsurprising, to say the least. Even in the past, in peace talks between the Israelis and Palestinians, whenever there was a glimmer of hope and peace was on the horizon, Israel made sure to sabotage the peace process and then blame the Palestinians in order to make sure that a Palestinian state would never materialize and that the Israeli occupation would continue. Joining me is writer, commentator, and political analyst Shermin Narwani. Thanks for coming on the show. This attack that took place at Natanz, you know, the Israeli media, they've all but admitted that the Mossad is behind this. You know, on the one hand, though, they say it's an explosion. On the other, they say it's a cyber attack. And then they say the facility's been set back for 10 months. You know, just to get the story straight, can you give us an accurate damage assessment and tell us what took place at Natanz?
Yeah, so I wasn't there. However, you know, reading the various contradictory media reports, I think what we can ascertain is that whatever happened was related to the power in the facility, okay? So the power in that facility is a self-enclosed power system. It's not connected to the city of Tehran or outside, so something was done to the power network in the facility. And as you say, Israelis, and I think now even U.S. officials have suggested it was the Israelis, and they want it to be known, clearly, that it was the Israelis. In terms of it being out of commission for a year, that we know is an exaggeration, because 2 days ago, the Iranians said that they would enrich at Natanz to 60%, and specifically in the Ahmadi Roshan part of the facility. That is the part where the power outage took place. So they're going right back into the very same facility that was targeted by the Israelis. So there's certainly no such thing as a year's, you know, delay.
So, you know, we've seen various reports in the last days that Iran is going to replace the centrifuges with advanced models. It's going to enrich uranium to 60%. Can you tell us what are some of the other responses that we've seen also in the last couple of days? You know, Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, Iran made it clear that this was a terrorist attack, and they reserve the right to respond.
So I just read yesterday that someone has been a person of, you know, who was suspected of carrying out this sabotage. Apparently, the Iranians have identified an individual. But on Tuesday, three things happened. One was that the Iranians said that they would enrich to 60%. The other was an attack on an Israeli-owned vessel in Fujairah, just off the coast of the UAE. And the third was, which we know happened, we know that took place. I don't think Iran has admitted to it. And the third thing was an attack on supposed Mossad agents in Erbil, several of whom were killed. Now, that has been both denied and confirmed. So we await the final results of that. So basically, the Israelis did what they did, and the Iranians are not in Vienna because they dragged the other parties there. If anything, it was the other way around. So the Israelis do these things, and the Iranians are miffed because, they understand fully that this is what Israel does, this is what Saudi Arabia does to undermine any progress with Iran. So they're not going to... They're not going to walk out of the talks based on this, but they needed to let them know, including the P5, that they would not tolerate this and they would up the ante accordingly. Now, 60% enrichment is not at all, weapons grade uranium. Even if it was 80%, it's not weapons grade uranium. So they've enriched just enough to make a significant leap to put the others on call. And I think the Iranians have been very disappointed that the IAEA at the top level and others have not condemned this, but in fact turned the focus on Iran's accelerated enrichment.
They just concluded the Joint Commission talks here in Vienna. Do you think, as a whole, that this attack at Natanz, it's strengthened Iran's position at the negotiating table? Do you think that it leaves them with a stronger hand to play?
So 100%. I think the Iranians have even said this is, improved our situation at the table. You know, if the Americans are serious about this, they should literally, kick their ally and say, okay, we're going to accept whatever. Let's not forget, though, again, that it's Iran did not call for these talks. It is the P5 that called for these talks. And the Americans that are super keen, after having postured for a good few months since Biden took office, that they are keen for these talks because they know in around 2 months, Iran will hold a presidential election. And the anticipation is that you will have someone who is less inclined to deal with the West and more hostile with the West, someone who will be sort of gearing Iran eastwards. And so this is if you will, Biden's window of opportunity. So Iran had the leverage going in, right? There was foul play, and Iran showed it's willing to. It can do anything it wants because it's not Iran that needs to be there; it's the other parties. But it hasn't played sour. It's Iran's turned up at the meetings and is progressing with goodwill, if you will. So look, Richard, I'll tell you something. I this is really important. Basically, the winners and losers in the Middle East, from the Levant to the Persian Gulf, are fairly clear in every battlefield. What is left is attempts to gain leverage so they can negotiate the peace with something in hand, okay? And unfortunately for the West, they don't have a lot. You know, they've played their hands in all the theaters. They've gone in directly, fighting in wars. They've used proxies. You know, they've sold highest grade weaponry to their allies in the region. So really these talks are about the remaining P5 members and Iran finding a face-saving exit for the U.S., a face-saving way for the Americans to drop the sanctions and accept Iran's terms.
Just to wrap up, because you spoke of chess. You know, some people are saying that this act of sabotage, it's designed to, you know, to trip Iran up, and it's a trap. Basically force Iran to leave the talks and undermine diplomacy. And, you know, there are other people who are also saying that Iran has been too patient. It's shown too much goodwill, you know, because Iran's come correct so far with everything, and you just can't reason with the West, and they won't engage in diplomacy. What's your take on that? And, you know, how would you describe the overall political atmosphere in Iran and how people are reacting to the decisions that have been made so far?
You know, just today, the Russians and Iranians inked a deal to receive, I think, 60 million Sputnik V vaccines. When the Iranian people are looking at what's happening on a global stage, they are seeing the Americans unwilling to uphold agreements. I mean, actually, this is bad for all America's allies in the region, because they understand that America's not going to be there to save them anymore. You know, they will not act. I mean, don't forget when Iran shot down that $200 million U.S. drone, and when Iran shot a dozen ballistic missiles into U.S. bases in Iraq, there was a non-reaction. You know, I would have loved to be a fly on the wall, you know, in the room that Mohammed bin Zayed and Mohammed bin Salman were in at that moment. You know, what? No reaction. And so I think the Iranian people see the Americans walked from the deal, and the Iranians are not going to take bold steps towards this deal because they can't be made to look like fools twice, and nobody has the appetite for it. But again, I think it consolidates this growing view in Iran that when the Americans left, the Chinese bought our oil, they inked a strategic partnership with Iran that is to last 25 years, bring the Belt and Road through our territories, you know. And the Russians, and just in the last week, Iran has hit the worst stage of coronavirus, this pandemic it's had since the beginning, and the Russians stepped up with vaccines. So, you know, I think Iranians, if they're calculating, they're looking at who their friends have been in tough times and who have not. Now, it's remarkable to me that Israel sabotages Iran's main nuclear facility, which, by the way, is compliant 100%. It is under the strictest inspections regime we have ever seen in our history. Cameras rolling 24/7. Iran announced to the IAEA prior to going public that they are going to raise enrichment to 60%. They've dotted the I's and crossed the T's, and yet the Europeans are blaming Iran for this. The scrutiny is now on Iran for taking such a, you know, unhelpful position. So the thing is, Iran's not playing with friends. It's very clear. The only ones on Iran's side in these negotiations are the Chinese and the Russians, and particularly the Russians, who stood up yesterday and said the U.S. has to drop all sanctions. You know, plain and simple.